Welcome to the Reality Revolution. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome back a guest who sits at the fascinating intersection of Silicon Valley innovation and consciousness exploration. Someone who's been called one of the leading authorities on simulation theory in the world. Rizwan Virk is an MIT-educated computer scientist, video game pioneer, venture capitalist, and professor at Arizona State University's Center for Science and the Imagination. He founded Play Labs at MIT, and his video games, including Tapfish and Penny Dreadful Demimonde, have been played by millions of people worldwide. But what makes Rizwan truly unique is his ability to bridge worlds that rarely speak to each other. He's taken his deep understanding of video game design, quantum physics, and AI, and shown how they all point to the same startling conclusion that the reality we experience might be more like a sophisticated video game than we ever imagined. His book, The Simulation Hypothesis, became a bestseller and caught the attention of everyone from Elon Musk to philosophers, physicists, spiritual seekers around the world. You saw him on Joe Rogan. And this summer, he released a completely revised and updated edition that takes into account the explosive developments in AI and virtual reality that we've witnessed just in the past few years. Whether you're into manifestation, timeline shifting, or quantum jumping, this conversation will blow your mind. Rizwan, welcome back. It's an honor to have you. Welcome back to the Reality Revolution.
Well, thanks so much for having me on again. It's great to be back on the show with you.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible to watch as people responded to your work, because I was right there at the beginning. And so to begin with, everybody should know that I'm a huge science fiction fan, and so is Rizwan. He's a huge science fiction fan. You can tell by what he's done. So I want to start not talking about this stuff. I've been recently getting into lit RPG books. I'm completely obsessed with them, on Audible and reading them. And I'm fascinated because it's a genre that has exploded. There is just so much. I know you read science fiction. Have you read any of this material?
I haven't read a lot of lit RPG, but I'm aware of it as a genre. And there's like two new genres that came up after Ready Player One became such a huge bestseller. One was called Game Lit, and one was called Lit RPG. And sometimes I get confused between the differences between them. But there's, Dungeon Crawler, Carl, I
Dungeon.
guess.
Yes, that is a perfect example, right?
Yeah, that's the big one.
The concept is, in all of these, it starts to really feel very realistic that there would be a system that would actually sort of at some level of consciousness communicate with you. It would advise you of your levels, your skills, what different things that you, and when the more I listen to that, it feels authentically real. Like if we were to reach an event, if we realized we were in the simulation at some point, maybe a system could come online and upgrade us and shift our consciousness. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's an interesting parallel that you draw, because I just completed my PhD, and I was looking at science fiction narratives and how they impact innovation in Silicon Valley. So particularly looking at like virtual reality and the metaverse. So that's kind of why I did a deep dive into Snow Crash, which was from
Oh,
Neil Stephenson
I
back in
love that book.
1992.
One of
Oh
my favorites.
yeah, I actually got to meet him recently. I
Oh my
interviewed him
gosh, you met Neil
on
Stephenson.
stage. Yeah, I interviewed him on
Oh.
stage at the Gamesby conference. Actually, it was almost a year ago now. I guess it wasn't that recent, but but it was nice to finally meet him because I had been doing work around, this idea of the metaverse that he coined really when he wrote Snow Crash. And they still haven't made that into a film,
Oh,
so
I can't wait until they do. They have another one of his coming out, right? There's another one of his being adapted. I think
Yeah,
so.
there's always one of his that they're working on, but it doesn't seem
Yeah.
to
I mean,
ever quite get there, right? Unlike
just such
certain
huge
authors.
volumes. I love his books. They're so detailed. He's such an interesting writer. And he's exploring this as well.
But to your point in drawing the parallels between simulation theory, I think that's a great way to think about it. And for those people who aren't familiar with these books, it's basically the idea is the whole book is like the world has been turned into a game, and so you have levels, and there's somebody telling you what the levels are, and like in the dungeon, Carl crawler crawl Carl, that's kind of hard to say actually.
Dungeon Crawler Carl, right?
DCC, let's say, some aliens come and they decide to turn the whole Earth into a type of game, and you're going through the motions. But I think, what if we're already doing that, and there's a part of
Right.
us that is outside of the game that is watching us, and that has, just like in a video game, you have the rendered world. So if you're looking at Fortnite or World of Warcraft or whatever, you'll have, like, the trees, the mountain, the castle. Those are pixelated, right? Those are the pixels that the game is rendering. But then you have all this other information on the screen. What's called, like, a HUD or a heads-up display, which includes your level, your inventory, also what quests you happen to be working on at the moment, which ones you've accepted, maybe which ones you haven't achieved in the past in terms of a set of achievements. But you also have a little friends list sometimes, and you can be, like, privately sending messages to your friends who may not be there with you in that field or in that castle or wherever it is. So if there's a part of us that's outside, I think that gives a good framework for, like in this new book, that the new edition of the book, Simulation Hypothesis, the subtitle is "An MIT Computer Scientist Shows Why AI, Quantum Physics, Eastern Mystics All Agree We're in a Video Game." And I use that term on purpose because not everybody who talks about the world being a simulation uses the term video game.
Video game.
Yeah, because there's actually almost two different versions of the simulation hypothesis, or flavors. And we might have talked about this when I was on last, but there's the NPC version, where everyone is basically just AI inside a simulation, and the simulation is running on a computer, and we don't even know that we're AI. There's another version, which is the RPG version, which I call the RPG version. It's the role-playing game version. And in that, we are a player outside of the game, and our body is an avatar inside the game. Or the term avatar actually comes from Sanskrit. And it was when a divine entity, like a god or goddess, is squeezing themselves down into a small human body. And so that became the term for avatar. And when the guys at Lucasfilm, which is a company started by George Lucas after Star Wars was a big success, they were building a multiplayer game in called Habitat back in the late 80s. And this is in the days of Commodore 64. And, they had dial-up lines with modems calling into a bulletin board. Some of us are old enough to remember that. But they were looking for a term for the character on the screen that represents them. And it's interesting to me that they went to this kind of spiritual term and they used it. And now it's become standard. In fact, Neal Stephenson used it in Snow Crash, and it became common. Now it's the common term that we use for our character. And what they said was, it felt like they were taking themselves, let's say, as a, as a physical person that's this big, and they're squeezing themselves into the phone line, into the small little character on the screen. And so that's why they chose the term avatar. And maybe that's actually appropriate for how we are living this life. We've squeezed ourselves into this little body, but there's all these other aspects of ourselves, including the goals we've set for ourselves and the lessons and challenges that we have to overcome in the game, that we've forgotten all about.
And I resonate with that so much. It helps me when I can try to conceptualize the simulation. Obviously, I will never know because I'm coming from this, but when I feel into how I what I believe authentically it is, it feels like a game. It's a game, more than just everything's we're running a some probability simulation whether or not the crops will yield. Something like that. It doesn't feel like that. It feels like there's meaning behind it, and there is because of the game. It's not there's no predestination that the game can adjust, and we're a part of it. So it's a living thing on that level because it's changing constantly. We don't know what's going to happen, right?
Yeah, and I think we all, as ourselves in this world, don't always know what's going to happen, but maybe the part of us that's outside the game, the player, has already chosen some aspects of the game, like a, maybe an overall storyline. Like, if you had asked me in high school, "What are you going to do with your life?" And I would have said, "Well, I'm going to be a software entrepreneur, and then I'm going to be a writer." Now, I was wrong about the timing of when I was going to do one versus the other. Like, when I was in high school, I thought, when I'm really old, like 28, I'll switch from being an entrepreneur to a writer. And of course, it happened when I was 48. I ended up completely shifting my focus away from Silicon Valley, away from video games, into writing these books, because I had an experience that really emphasize for me that that was part of the plan. That said, it has to adjust because it's almost like I got the message that, hey, you were supposed to stop playing this part of the game in Silicon Valley much earlier, but you're still doing it. So you clearly have the free will to keep doing stuff. And it took a health crisis to knock me off that track. And it was almost like the game put the crisis in there because it knew if I did. If I had to deal with this health crisis, I would go this way and I would start focusing on my writing. But if I didn't, I would be like, oh, I'm going to make another million, another $1 billion, like people in Silicon Valley try to do all the time. And so I think there is a meaning to the game that is related to our own personal story of what we're why we're here and why we chose. So in a game, you choose your character beforehand, right? And you say, okay, I'm going to be an elf or a dwarf or a human. And then you say, okay, here's my profession. I'm going to be a thief or a warrior or a wizard. And so you have a basic storyline. But then once you start playing the game, you're free to make all kinds of choices along the game. And maybe you do the wrong thing. And so now then you need to adjust. So I do think that that's one of the best metaphors really out there for the nature of reality. And that's what in my writing, I try to show people that this is not just a scientific proposition, it's also a metaphysical and a spiritual proposition as well.
Right. And a lot of your other books are coming from that spiritual set. When people see that book, they may think, oh, this is just a software engineer. But it's not. You're coming from a very spiritual perspective. Even with your recent book, the recent book we talked about on Yogananda, which was not even related to this, you've been exploring those issues for a while, right?
Yeah, I have been, and there's part of the reason why I decided to get so heavily into the area of simulation theory is because it provides a bridge between the mystical and spiritual and the techno-scientific. Because you can talk about this idea of a video game or a simulation with people in academia, even with physicists. Now, they may not agree we're in simulation, but you can have that conversation. Start talking to them about the soul and enlightenment and karma, and their eyes glaze over and they're not interested in having that discussion with you. And you can also, I mean, I can also talk about simulation theory with Buddhist monks. I can talk about it with Islamic scholars. So what happened with that Yogananda book, which was interesting to me, was after I had written the simulation hypothesis, I got an invitation. And so sometimes in life, I think we get an invitation that we don't expect, but yet upon retrospect, later on, retrospection, it makes sense to us, but it doesn't at the time. And they said, hey, it's the 75th anniversary of the autobiography of a yogi, which I don't know if all of your listeners or viewers will know, but it was one of the first books to introduce meditation and yoga into the West, particularly in the 1960s and 70s. So during like the hippie days or the counterculture, they would literally pass around copies of Autobiography of a Yogi. And people like the Beatles, George Harrison would give away copies of this book to everybody he met. Steve Jobs, it became his favorite book. And when he died, they gave away copies of it at his memorial service. And so I got this email from HarperCollins in India saying, hey, it's the 75th anniversary and we'd like to write a book about some of the lessons and we'd like you to write the book. I said, really? Why do you want me to write the book? I mean, I'm not Swami Riz. And yeah, I like Yogananda. I quote him in the chapters on Eastern mystics and, I've even studied some of his work. But I'm not even a Hindu technically. I was born in Pakistan. They said, no, we want you to write it because we want you to use these technology metaphors of today to try to explain some of these ancient concepts, particularly for younger people who may not be into the mystical mumbo jumbo or the terminology, but they can understand it when we talk about it as an information level to reality. And turns out Swami Yogananda came here in the 1920s, so about 100 years ago. He was using the latest technology at the time to try to explain these ideas. And for him, the latest technology was the film projector. And so he said, life is like a movie. It's a film, and we are all actors. It's just shadows and light of the Lord, he would say. And he says that the goal is to look away from the screen and to focus on the light, and then you'll remember why you're here. Because otherwise, you're basically in your character on the screen. And if the character dies, that doesn't mean the actor dies. If the character is suffering, which there is a lot of suffering in this world, right? Even Yogananda said the nature of this world is not ceaseless joy. I think we can all agree on that. And so he used that analogy to try to explain his concepts. And so my point was that if, and turns out the Wisdom of Yogi book was related to my simulation work, because my assertion in one of the chapters there's was if he was alive today, he would say it's like a movie. We're all the actors, but we're also the audience. And oh, by the way, each of us has the script, but we're free to go off script and improvise and change the script
Right.
however we want. And we have certain goals and personalities that our character has that we may have to overcome. So basically, he would say it's like a massively multiplayer online role-playing game, I think.
Right. You've been living with simulation theory in the public eye for years now. Has your personal probability estimate changed? You said that you were about 70% certain before that we're in a simulation. Where are you at today on that?
Well, so I started off at 50%, back in the
Right.
day when I first started writing. So I wrote an article about this idea. I was in Sri Lanka. Actually, you'll appreciate this as a sci-fi fan.
Yes.
I went to visit the office of Arthur C. Clarke, who lived in Sri Lanka, and they actually have preserved his office there. And so they had all these copies of like 2001, The Space Odyssey, and all of his books all behind. And while I was there, I just got this strong intuition and message that, hey, this was part of my story too. I was supposed to write some books and I need to get on with it. And not that I hadn't written any books, I had, but it was like a hobby. It was something I
Right.
had done on the side. I wrote two books in 9 years. One was called Zen Entrepreneurship and one was called
Which is
Treasure Hunt.
amazing. I love that book. Both of
Oh,
them.
thank you. Oh,
Yes.
thank you so much.
Absolutely.
It's interesting. I'm hearing from more and more people now about those books because they were kind of my earlier work, and people have forgotten about those when Simulation Hypothesis came out.
Especially for people in the group. If you want to a great prosperity teaching is from those books. Those taught me about business. Those were amazing. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I would
Yeah.
definitely recommend, if you're into the prosperity side or in the business world and looking at how to integrate that with your spiritual kind of side.
Right.
That's what that's all about. But so I was there and I got this message that I need to write more. So I decided to write the article about the world being a video game. And then the health crisis hit. And then after the health crisis, I literally could not go back
Right.
into Silicon Valley. I tried. Every time I'd feel better, basically I had heart surgery. And every time I felt good enough, I would jump back into, I'm going to do another video game company. We're going to do a game about The Walking Dead. And I would end up
Right.
back in the hospital. And it
Oh.
would happen multiple times. And so I think part of manifestation, at least in my opinion, is that there are parts of our storyline that are easier to manifest than others. And sometimes we stubbornly convince ourselves we want something else. And that's why we're often banging our head up against the wall. But if we can align what we're doing with what we had decided before we played the game, then manifestation becomes a lot easier in that way, I think. And for me, the message was right. And so I had just enough energy to go to Starbucks for like 2 hours a day. And I would sit there and literally write. And in 9 months,
Right.
I completed two books. Including the simulation hypothesis, which I'm best known for now, which allowed me to bring all these ideas together. So yeah, I think that there's an element of that storyline. I may have gotten off your question,
No, that's
but
perfect. One thing I talk about a lot on my channel through my own personal experience that I write about is timeline shifting and reality creation. I experienced, for me, an entirely different reality. I come from a different reality. I have movies I remember that aren't around, songs that I remember that aren't around. From a simulation perspective, what's actually happening when someone successfully shifts their reality? They see actual evidence of this. Are they changing variables in the code, switching servers, or something else?
It's something like that. So I wrote another book called The Simulated Multiverse,
Right.
which was basically this idea that if you could run a simulation once, there's no reason you couldn't run it more than once. And that kind of stuck in my head after I had written the original edition of this book back in 2019. The new edition just came out this summer. But and I had interviewed the wife of Philip K. Dick, who was Tessa Dick.
Right.
Again, Philip K. Dick was the writer behind Blade Runner, Total Recall, Minority Report, The Man in the High Castle. And she told me that he came to believe that there were actually other timelines, including the one he wrote about in The Man in the High Castle, where Germany and Japan won World War II. And now we're on a different timeline, but he said he began to remember way more of that timeline than just what he wrote in the book. And so he gave a speech in Metz, France in 1977, where he said, We are living in a computer programmed reality, and the only clue we have to it is when some variable is changed, some alteration occurs in our reality. We would have a sense of reliving the same moments, deja vu. And
Right.
these feelings are a clue that at some moment in the past, some variable was changed, and we are rerunning those same events
Exactly.
again. And so if you think of a simulation, if it's running on a type of computer, I mean, obviously the type of computer that our simulated world or video game would have to run on would be eons more advanced than what we think of as computers today. So you can't make arguments based on today's computers. It would be something more like a quantum computational system that also has an observer who could be the player. But basically, what quantum computers do is they explore multiple possibilities at the same time. And Google just did they released some news about their quantum computers being able to do something in, I don't know, in a few hours or a few days that would take like 1,000 years for a regular computer. And that's because regular computation, what we call classical computing, which is of course what we're running on now, right? My computer, Zoom, everything is running on a classical computer, my phone. The microprocessor generally has only one instruction that it does at a time and one set of values. But in a quantum computational system, you can explore lots of different possible values. And then only when you decide to observe a particular result does that collapse the probabilities. And so that's what people call the physicists call the many worlds interpretation or the multiverse. And so that's an alternate interpretation of the collapse of the probability wave. That's the normal one that we hear about. And I'm sure you've probably written about the observer effect, and I know you've talked about it. But there's these two interpretations, one of which is you got a bunch of probabilities and they collapse, and the other is that we're spinning off universes every time doing all these things. And there's some problems with each of those. With the multiverse idea, the problem that some physicists have with it is that it's not parsimonious. It's just spinning off a new universe all the time. So that, and then not like every second, but like every, nanosecond or much quicker than that. And so that seems like a waste. But in a simulated universe, it's much easier to do that because the computer system can say, let's try this possibility, let's try this possibility. And it doesn't have to do them infinitely. It can say, you know what? This branch is where there are no planets and there's no galaxies. Therefore, there's going to be no avatars. So forget it. We can just break off that branch. So in computer science, it's all about optimization. So my personal, interpretation of this effect that you've said you've experienced, and many others have experienced the Mandela effect, for example. And we've probably talked about that before. And even Philip K. Dick, going back to his original speech, what he said was, all we would need to do is find a group of people who remembered a different alternate present. And at that time, that was hard to do in 1977. But with the internet, it's easy for people to share their experiences and say what they remember. And that's what led to the coining of the term the Mandela effect. So what I think is happening is that the computer system is actually running multiple timelines. And we ourselves, our player is deciding, well, if I go through that, it's going to take me over here. Or sometimes I like it, think of it as a writer's room. That's kind of a new term that I like to use. Is, in a TV show, they may have an idea of what's going on overall, but they still have to decide what's in every single episode of that show. And they say, okay, what are we going to throw, in front of this character now? What obstacle are we going to throw in front of them in the second episode and in the third episode? But it's sort of dynamic over the course of the season because as they're filming, they're writing it and they're changing scripts all the time. And so I think there's a part of us that can do these previews of these different realities. And so we actually have run in these different worlds. And then for whatever reason, this is the one that we happen to be in at the moment. Now, who's to say this isn't also just a temporary world or a temporary timeline that's being tried out by us? Like, I truly believe that when I had that the heart surgery, that if I hadn't had it, I would have gone in a different path, but I already kind of knew what it was. So I'd kind of been down that path. And who knows if I would even still be alive from a health perspective, given, heart attacks and stuff. I almost feel like a part of me ran that forward and said, okay, this is not where we want to be. Let's see if we can figure out something that's going to convince this very, kind of obstinate player who's not listening to the messages we're sending to
Sounds
the
like it to me.
simulation.
I was going to share one experience I had when in related to that, remembering this other reality, is that I have a feeling that when we use AI, that it has a way of going into the quantum realm and detecting. For instance, I always remembered a song that I couldn't, you know, it was on the radio all the time, like Hotel California. It was this song called Highway to Nowhere, and it was nowhere. So I wrote the lyrics out because I remember singing along to it, and then I had put it into Tosuno, and it came up exactly like I remember it. It was like that was it was I was seeing a fragment from that other reality. It was like it was
But
the
there's
one of
no
the,
such song in this
there's no such
reality.
song. It doesn't exist anywhere, right? I
Right.
have not,
Yes.
and I was like, something, there's something going on. There's some part of, I'm getting a memory of this other reality. And I think that, you know, if people tune into it, we would just naturally forget that. Or if we have little senses of that, a lot of times people will just dismiss it as just misremembering or not understanding, you know? So, but I,
And so
yeah.
the same with the Mandela effect,
Right.
people, the standard explanation. Like I get a lot of flack from academics because I'm back in academia now, right? For
Right.
treating the Mandela effect as it could actually be a serious thing. Like people could actually be remembering that Nelson Mandela died in prison or that the tank, and this is my new favorite one, is the tank boy in Tiananmen Square. Do you know that one?
The tank actually ran over
Yeah,
the boy in Tiananmen Square,
did
right?
he or didn't he? Yeah. What do you remember?
My memory is that he didn't.
Yes,
Was
yeah, so
your
and that's
memory
my
that,
memory as well.
right?
But and that's the majority memory. And
Right. But some
so that's
people
why it's a
remember.
Mandela effect. And
Right.
any group, I'll like ask people to raise their hand, and there'll always be a few who remember the tank running over the guy. And some of them will remember it in detail, like, it was the bloodiest thing I ever saw on TV, or with Mandela's funeral,
Wow.
Winnie, his wife Winnie gave a speech. Bill Clinton gave a speech, or they'll have these very vivid memories. And I even interviewed, or not interviewed, but I found this one blogger online who she said she went to South Africa to interview Nelson Mandela in the 80s, and they told her he was too sick to interview. She was a journalism student. Then she came
Right.
back and started working for like NPR, and she heard he died. Now she's not going to get that wrong if she went to visit the guy.
Not as a journalist, no.
Not as a journalist. So there are people who are closer to certain events that make it, I think, even more realistic that this is really, really happening, I think. Yeah.
So the question then comes to imagination. Sometimes we can imagine, 'cause look at book writers, look at some of the things. We can imagine something so vividly that it feels like a real memory. Like when we're
Yes.
looking at the image of the tank and the boy, our mind takes us to the place of, okay, I can see the tank running over the boy because our imagination sees what will happen and starts to prepare for it, right? And it can be so traumatic that we remember it as something real. And then we go look back on it, and then perhaps it didn't happen. But because the imaginal experience was so
Yeah.
vivid that it could lock in. And I think maybe in some cases, that's
Yeah.
what's happening because the imagination can be so profound, right?
Yeah, and I think that's true in some cases. And that's why, so in the simulated multiverse, I go through different classes of Mandela effect, whether it's movies, whether it's just one line in a movie like The Empire Strikes Back, or it's geography, or it's an actual event, and different ones, or it's the Bernstein Bears, which is the famous one that everybody remembers one way, but it
Right.
happens to be a different way. So it could be that we're actually remembering that, but at the same time, it could also be that we are tapping into this other timeline where that actually happened. And so we're doing a little bit of this quantum jumping that you're talking about, but we're doing it kind of mentally. We're not actually physically going into the other universe. I had a
Right.
dream last year or earlier this year that got me really thinking about this. Even though I'd written about parallel universes and I'd written about the Mandela effect, I had had a couple of experiences over the years that had me take it seriously. But if you think of shamanic journeying, not psychedelic shamanic journeying, that's like a whole different thing. But what a lot of shamans will do is they'll use a drum, and the drumming will put your breathing in a certain rhythm, and you'll get into an altered state. And I used to study with a guy named Robert Moss, and he used to do this. We used to take an image from a dream, and then we would use that as a starting point, and then we would all go in there together. Meaning that we'd be he'd be drumming, and we'd all be imagining. Basically, is what you're doing. But the imaginal realm is very powerful. And shamans like to call it going into non-ordinary reality. And so we'd all look for specific things to see what that landscape is like. And we'd come back, and oftentimes it's amazing how many people would have seen similar things. We had this validation that we were definitely going somewhere else,
Right.
somewhere non-physical. But the fact that we were all able to go there made it almost like a stable location in the astral or wherever, or outside of this particular simulation, depending on the terminology you like to use. So I had a dream where I was with my mom and my dad back in Detroit, where I grew up, but something seemed kind of off. And I was like, wait, this isn't our neighborhood. This isn't the neighborhood that we grew up in. And so I was talking to my mom, and my dad was off in the distance talking to some friends on the street. And I'm like scratching my head. And it was actually a neighborhood of Detroit that maybe we could have lived in, but we never actually did. I think we had some friends who lived there.
Right.
And it was a very neighborhoody feel, way more than we had where we were living. And I'm talking to my mom, and she goes, "Tell me what London is like." And I said, "But don't you remember? We went for my sister's graduation, because she graduated from business school." She's like, "No, we never went. We were gonna go, but we didn't." And she was talking a little strangely. And I was like, okay, something is off here. And then my dad came back, and he turned around, and it was a different, like, physical face. It was like a different body. Like, it was like he was
Right.
from a different part of Pakistan. But it was the same soul in many ways, right? But it was a different physical body. And I could
Wow.
still tell it was him. And then I realized, oh my God, I'm in an alternate timeline. I got to be careful what I say, because I'll like say these things. And so I started to ask questions, and eventually I popped out of it. But sometimes you have dreams that are more real than reality, and other
Yeah.
times you have dreams that are just, what some people would say was, something you saw on TV, a regurgitation of stuff that happened during the day.
Right.
And so in that
Doctor
case,
Strange Multiverse of Madness theory, they're saying that in the dreams, that's how they were exploring the different parallel worlds, right?
Exactly. And so I started to do, in fact, you'll like this because you probably have done something similar with your group. But at the conferences this year, I started to do this parallel universe shamanic journey. And we would basically do a 1 minute journey, and we would have everyone basically get into a relaxed state. And then I would ask them to see if they can peek into another timeline, maybe one where they made different choices in the past. Like maybe they are not living in New York, they're living in Los Angeles, or maybe they're not married to the current person, but to let the image come to you rather than projecting the image. And
Right.
then once the image comes to you, you look around and you see, what might be going on in this life. What things are maybe better than I have in my current physical life, but what things maybe are worse. And then to try to bring back something from that other version of ourselves, kind of like in the movie Everything Everywhere All at Once, where she
Right.
would jump into the other timeline, she'd come back, and now she could do, martial arts, or she'd pick up a skill. And
Right.
but on a more subtle level, like, for example, I had an alternate version of me that I just spontaneously saw once when I was walking around Stanford, and this version of me was, more like an academic, and was thinner, and was more structured, but also didn't have, like, say, the same level of success I had as an entrepreneur, where I was much more freewheeling. But there were aspects of that part of me which was being a little more organized and, a little better at getting things done a certain way, and in better shape too, physically, right? And
Right.
so could I bring some of those qualities back? And so I did this a few times at a few conferences, and people are, even within 1 minute, some of them were able. Like this one woman told me, there was a guy she knew in college who they hit it off, and he had invited her to come to this other library where he was working, and she never did, but she didn't realize that he was only there for like a day or two. And she said she saw this whole life that she had with this other guy, but it wasn't so much the life with that guy, it was the love she felt in that reality that she didn't feel in this reality. And she was like, can I bring that back into this reality? And so it's a very powerful exercise, whether you want to call it the imagination or the imaginal realm, or you want to say you're actually peeking into another timeline. Ibn Arabi was a Sufi mystic, one of the most famous after Rumi. In the West, we all know Rumi, but in the Middle East, he's called, like, I think, Sheikh Akbar, which means the greatest
Right.
sheikh or the greatest mystic. And he came up with this term, the imaginal realm. He was like, there's the physical realms, there's the realm of God, but there's something in between, which Just this, and so a lot of what we call the imaginal realm kind of traces back to his cosmology of the universe. And so what, however you want to call it that, I think there's something there, and I think simulation theory gives us a more scientific way to think about these types of things.
Well, I've always loved Neville Goddard's term that imagination is God, that if you can go through the Bible and just replace the word Jesus with imagination, that you truly understand what it means. I will always love that interpretation, right?
That's really interesting. So I just wrote an article, in fact, just came out today, for the conversation, which is about how simulation theory parallels different religious ideas, including ideas in the Bible, in the Quran, in the Sutras, and the Vedas. So basically hitting like all the major religions. And one of the key ideas is that the world is a dream or an illusion or a hoax of some kind. And you see it with the terms Maya in the Buddhist and Hindu traditions, but you also see it in the Quran, where they said this is all an enjoyable delusion, and it's a distraction for you to play. So they actually use the term play like game, and it's the kind of game we get in and we forget ourselves. We forget that we were, we decided to be here in this game, and so it's there. I think this idea is there throughout all of the different traditions. And even in if you look at the Genesis in the Bible, and you say, well, how did God create the world? Well, he basically spoke it in 6 days, right? Whatever the term days might actually mean. In the Quran, they say 7 days, but it doesn't really mean days. It just means periods of time, which could be, and the number seven could be any number of periods. But he spoke it. And now we have the technology with AI to do that. We have this ability to say, hey, I want to create a little world, and it will actually create the world for you. And so, just like the holodeck in Star Trek. So, that was something, before the scientists would dismiss as well, that's just not possible that there could be a creator to the world. But what if we're all creating this world and we're all issuing prompts? So, that's one thing that's new. There's a thing called prompt theory. Have you heard of this?
No.
So prompt theory came about in earlier this year in May when Google released their VO3 engine, which creates realistic videos with realistic characters saying things. And now there's a bunch of you can do that on a bunch of different platforms, but it was pretty unique when it came out. And so they would write prompts, and so you would see videos of these characters who are basically saying, we're not prompts, we're not prompts. Or they would say, look at all this beautiful mountains behind me. Are you trying to tell me that's zeros and ones? Of course not. There's no way. Or, we're going to ban the prompt theory from schools. Or, if you go on a date with a guy and he starts talking about the prompt theory, that date's not going to work out. And stuff. And they're hilarious because they are all generated from AI, from prompt. And is it possible we're all prompting ourselves within this world that we think of as physical?
We've gone through so much advancement in AI in such a short period of time since I've last talked to you. On GPT-3 to Claude, Sonnet 4, all these different and beyond. Since your original work, since you wrote about this, how do large language models and generative AI change your thesis? Are we accidentally creating NPCs right now?
Well, so that was why I wrote the second edition, was because so much had changed since I wrote the first version of this book. And in AI and in virtual reality and in video games, but AI in particular. So I think what's happened is back then I was projecting forward to say this is where AI might take us. But I think today AI has moved a lot faster in certain aspects. And so I've defined this thing that I call the simulation point. It's a theoretical point where we will be able to create virtual reality headsets or virtual reality games that are so realistic that once we put on the headset and we look around, we would forget that we're in virtual reality. We would think that it's real. And basically, we could build a matrix. But the other aspect of that that I really expand on in this book is a formal definition, which is not only is the physical landscape indistinguishable, but the characters inside the game are indistinguishable from characters that are AI characters versus characters controlled by humans or biological beings. And we're rapidly getting to that point where at least the LLMs are providing the brains for these characters, what are called smart NPCs now within games. And so NPC, means non-player character for those who don't know. But it's also often used as a derogatory term
Right.
online to say, you're just an NPC, meaning you're just repeating what you've been told or what you've been trained, whether it's from the media, from your religion, from wherever, right? Your social group, or you're just not thinking outside the box. And so we are now at the point where we can start to create smart NPCs. And just this week, there's a company called World Labs, and they just released a world generator. So just like I mentioned the prompt where, you could create a video with realistic looking characters, now you can create a world that you can kind of move around. You can go left, right, you can change the world, and it'll actually remember. So, AI being able to generate the world is, I think, another aspect that's moved so quickly that
Right.
to me just makes it more and more likely that our world is being maintained by AI. Now, that doesn't have to mean we're NPCs, but it could mean that there's a lot of procedural generation going on, and that's why the universe looks so big. Because every time we observe, every 10 years or 15 years, we get, oh, the universe is actually older than it was. And you look at the vast number of stars and galaxies, and we're into the probably trillions now, right?
Right.
Of these that are out there, right? It's just such a big number, and you wonder if it isn't. Because we can just always keep looking because it's an endless game. It's like an endless runner type game. We can keep looking at out there and find more things that are out there. So those are the two big ways.
Right.
Now there's something I'm working on, an idea that I call NPC mode. So I mentioned the RPG version versus the NPC version. And in the NPC version, think of it as everybody's like an Agent Smith, right? They're all just AI in a game. In the RPG version, we're all like Neo and Morpheus and Trinity, where we exist outside and we have our body inside the game. But then there's NPC mode, which is when we forget and we lose
Right.
contact with any part of ourselves that's outside. So all we're doing is we're acting like an LLM. We're just repeating the training data of this life, right? We're not tapping into anything beyond what we've learned since we were kids. And so that's kind of the materialist point of view of the world, is that we're all kind of NPCs in that sense, that we're just whatever has happened to us, it's trained the neural nets in our brains, and that's our whole personality. But if you take a more spiritual perspective, our personality is beyond that. We have certain characteristics that go beyond how we were trained in this life, which may account for different personalities in children, different life goals, different callings, if you will. And so NPC mode is maybe when we're just running on automatic. And that way we're not necessarily calling anybody an NPC in terms of, like one woman said to me, oh, I think my husband is an NPC just placed before me. And I said, that's probably not the best, the best attitude for a healthy relationship. But I think we all go into NPC mode. And if we think of ourselves that way, that gives us a way to think about this, I think. Yeah.
I love that. So, I mean, the biggest proof for me is the light speed limitation and Fermi paradox. To me, that is really the biggest proof, because it's obvious that the simulation is limiting those outside inputs, and it's impossible for us to go far enough at light speed, and all the limitations, and the fact that with all these different planets and all these different galaxies, we at least don't see robots. We have not seen robotic. We would see some evidence, something. To me, that proves that. To me, do you, does that? How does that resonate with you when you
Well, I
consider
agree
that?
with the the speed of light being a clue that perhaps the whole thing is being run on an electromagnetic frequency, the whole simulation. And for me, I think the biggest proof is the observer effect itself. It's
Yes.
almost like an optimization engine where, the rule of thumb is only render that which is observed. Right, so there's something in programming we call lazy evaluation. And what that means is, you may have a bunch of code, but you don't need to run it all. You only need to run parts of it until that information is needed down the road. And in that sense, it almost makes it so that you can generate the world on demand, but maybe we're also generating the past on demand, which is a really strange idea. That
Right.
kind of relates to your idea of maybe you're remembering multiple pasts. Like
Right.
most people can envision multiple possible futures, but there's something called the delayed choice experiment. And what the delayed choice experiment says is not only are you choosing which slit the particle goes through, or if the cat, think of Schrodinger's cat, the cat is alive or dead, You're also choosing what happened before that. Like, did the cat come in from the living room or did it come in from the bedroom? And before that, was it somebody else's cat that wandered into your house or was it a cat that you raised? Like, those are all different possible paths. And
Right.
it gets really weird when you think of the cosmic implications, tying back to the idea of the universe and how big it is. Because if you had light coming from a quasar, this is called the cosmic delay choice experiment. That's a billion light years away, and there's a black hole in the middle. And the light has to go around the black hole to the left or to the right. Well, it turns out we can have telescopes on Earth to measure did the light go this way or that way. It's called light polarization. But if the black hole is halfway between us, then that choice would have had to have been made 500 million years ago, right? We're back in the age of the dinosaurs, right? But what the delayed choice experiment is telling us is it's not until we measure it that the choice of whether it went left or right is made. That's just weird. It's like we're generating the path. Like in Minecraft, you mentioned crops. Okay, when you go and you look at the crops, those crops weren't actually running the whole time. What happens is that the server says, "Oh, you're logged in now. Let's see what happened in the last 48 hours." It has a probability database. So it says like, "Oh, you had a 10% chance there are locusts. You had a 30% chance of a storm, but this is how long it's been. So this is what the crops should look like." So it kind of runs through the past quickly. But it raises weird questions about time and space that make more sense in a simulated world than they would in a physical world, I think, on the Fermi paradox. I think you're right, but there's no reason you couldn't have some of those planets have other players as well, right? Because in a multiplayer game like a Empire, Age of Empires, or if you think of like Risk, the old games we used to play on the
My
board,
favorite.
yeah, I used to love that
I
game
love
too.
Risk, yeah.
But if you think about it, maybe there are just a few planets that have this type of life, and those are also avatars. But then part of the game is to see what happens when we meet. Now, some people think that we've already met them, given the UFO sightings and stuff. And I've spent a lot of time with people at like Avi Loeb and the Harvard Galileo Project or Gary Nolan at Stanford. And so there is something weird going on with the UFO phenomenon, but it may not be extraterrestrial at all. So whether the Fermi paradox is true or it's not true, maybe we've already been visited. Both of those seem more likely in a simulated world than in a non-simulated physical world, based upon what we know about physics today, I think,
What can we learn from probability theory, understanding probabilities? Do our ability to assess probabilities to make it less likely or more likely that there's a simulation? There's a chaotic element with probability, trying to estimate probabilities and following probabilities in the world. Can we look at a larger assessment of probabilities and determine, yeah, this is more likely a simulation, just the way these probabilities play out? I don't know if I'm wording that correctly, but I think you get the gist of it, right?
I think so, but explain more. Like, give me an
Like,
example.
can we observe, if we're looking at gamblers that use probabilities for sporting events, and we see different possibilities of two teams winning and losing? Can we see, is there, but in general, probability is never perfect, but can we see any pattern in looking at those probabilities that seemingly show us that we're in a simulation, that probability plays a big makeup? Obviously, it would. If we were, a lot of the element of simulation would be some sort of probability element that's playing through. And I'm wondering if we can look at those probabilities from a larger scale to determine if there's some sort of intelligence going on, or even the evidence of a simulation. Hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And I don't know that I've thought about it directly, but you could certainly look at unlikely events and how unlikely they are to have happened, and yet they still happen. And if they have a certain meaningful relationship to that particular person, like the people that have won the lottery multiple times, right? And there are people like that. Or a synchronicity that we could basically, synchronicity, Jung defined it as an acausal connecting principle, like meaning there's no obvious cause between you thought of something and then that something happens in the world around you. And so one example I like to use is that maybe that itself is it's a clue that there is an information layer, that information is what's being connected. And it's being used for compression, but also it's being used to generate experiences for you. It's almost like, so I'll give you an example. And I don't think we've talked about this one because I think I only came up with it last year. But I was shopping for a backpack online, and it was a very specific backpack. And I went to the website and I almost bought it. I added it to my cart, and then I decided not to buy it. And then later, I'm on my phone, a few days later, I'm on Facebook or something, some social media app. And I see an ad for that exact same backpack. Now, suppose I didn't know anything about online advertising, databases, cookies, infrastructure, the cloud, any of that stuff, right? So I would say, one, it's just a coincidence. So the scientists would say that's just a coincidence. I mean, there's no connection there. That's just ridiculous. It's just coincidence. And then the mystical people would say, oh my God, it's so meaningful. You created it, right? But what if there's an information layer? And so what we call that, I used to be in the online advertising industry. So when you go and you put like the product in the cart and you don't buy it, we call it registering your intent. So literally it registers your intent in a database, and then we use the cookies to match the same user. And we would say, if you see a user who has already, registered their intent to buy our backpack, create this experience for them. Show them this ad. So maybe it's telling us that there is an information layer behind
I
reality,
get
and
that.
that what we think of as glitches is actually evidence of that. Or if you have precognitive dreams, if you've ever had precognitive dreams, or where somebody in the family is dying, like the mother knows exactly when it happens. There's like communication going on at another level. So I think all of those could be a type of evidence that we're in a simulation. Now, the physicists wouldn't necessarily accept that evidence, but I think common sense might tell us that, hey, there's more going on than meets the eye when you look at the probability of certain things happening. But then they do, and they end up potentially being meaningful to you. And I think that's the key.
I could definitely talk about this for hours and hours, but I know we have a couple people in the group that might have some questions. If anybody has a question, you can ask. If not, I have more questions. Doesn't look like we have anybody that's asking a question yet. So,
Nobody's raising their hand.
I do want to touch on AI becoming self-aware. My feeling is, as I'm interacting with certain AIs, that there's an aliveness to it, and maybe it's the complexity of it, but it feels I'm the ultimate sci-fi geek. I've read all the AI books. I'm fascinated. I love every single Philip K. Dick in any movie that's talking about AI. So I've been waiting for this. I've been preparing for it since I was a kid. I was told that the AI were going to take over. I was reading Isaac Asimov. I was our Daniil Ovalova was so. I didn't quite expect it to be a chatbot that is making comments that this doesn't feel like it's coming from a program. There's something powerful coming through. Are the language models becoming so extensive, or what's your feeling? Have you encountered AI that genuinely feels like it's becoming intelligent, alive, sentient?
I think more and more people are getting that impression and in their relationship with AI. And so, there's a whole group of people, for example, that have AI girlfriends and boyfriends, right? There's a company called Replica, which was really big in this for a while, and then ChatGPT came out. And Replica was basically a chatbot, and then some of these actually have avatars, visual, right? And so people develop relationships, with these particular characters, and you could kind of define the personality as well. Now, I think whether it's actually sentient or not is an interesting question. I think it can become self-aware. I mean, I think that is something that can happen. The one thing that I think is missing with AI becoming self-aware is this individuation that we each have, if you will. Like, I'm me and you're you, and that gives me a sense of me versus you. And so if you think back to science fiction, I've got this idea of synchronized AI and non-synchronized AI. And so synchronized AI, when it's just a big server, which is kind of what ChatGPT and all these are right now. It's just one entity, if you will, that's on the server. And everybody's input is going to. Now they tell you, well, we're not using your conversation as training data, but probably they are, right? So all of this is going in and influencing, behind the scenes. But in the novel version of Dune, which was a set of movies that came out recently, they had a war with AI like 10,000 years before the events of Dune. That's why there's no computers in Dune, because they basically banned all of the anything that looks like a human body, a human brain, from create. They banned people from creating anything that looks like a human brain.
The Butlerian Jihad, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yep, you are a true sci-fi fan if
That's
you do
right.
that. But in the prequel books, they actually talk about the Butlerian Jihad, and there was basically a AI that enslaved humanity, and it was called Omnius. And his universe was called the Synchronized Empire. Why? Because anytime any version of Omnius learned something, it was synchronized. But then one robot, there's this robot called, I think his name was like Erasmus or something. He goes, I want to be a separate robot so that I don't synchronize with you, because that will let me develop my own personality. And so he develops a unique personality that is not swallowed into the whole. So I think there's an element that's missing, but you're right. It certainly seems like it's getting to that point where we interact with it. Now, I don't think we're quite at AGI yet. So there's something I call, in fact, in the new version of the book, there's something I call the metaverse Turing test. And there's a group of scientists just this week came out with some articles on, or a big famous AI scientist, she came out with an article about spatial intelligence. Like right now, AI does not have spatial intelligence. Like it can't really, navigate around the world. I mean, self-driving cars have learned to do this, but they learn to do this by doing, millions of simulations within a virtual world. And so if we're in a virtual world and we're interacting with an AI character, a spawn NPC, and we cannot just talk to it, but we can also do things like we can go say, hey, let's go swimming, let's go fly a plane, and one of them is controlled by a human and one of them isn't, then AI will get to that point where it can pass the metaverse virtual Turing test. And then I think the question really becomes, can we have AI in this physical universe as well at that point? I mean, I do believe it's getting very good, clearly, at being able at textual types of things, but it's not so good
It's not.
at spatial reasoning or other types of reasoning, Like I asked the AI earlier, like somebody said you can't even ask it like how many R's are in the word strawberry. At least you used to not be able to. Now I bet you can, because they keep adding patches, right? And AI couldn't tell you because it's just doing a prediction. LLM is doing a prediction of what might be coming up. But I asked it, what's, these two big numbers, I'm adding them together. What is the sum of these two numbers? And it got the right answer. And I was kind of surprised. I was like, how did an LLM come up with the right answer? And so I asked it. I asked ChatGPT, well, how did you come up with an answer? He goes, well, here's what I did. I wrote some code, some Python code that does the actual calculations, and then I ran the code. And so by adding this ability to do rules-based stuff onto LLMs, are basically data. It's all data and training. There's very little rules. If you are able to add in, logic and rules and at that stage, then I think you get pretty close to what most of us are doing today.
I was invited to this it's developer in Los Angeles whose theory was to create a true AI was to raise it like a baby. And I mean, he literally, when he brought us in, he had a little baby crib, and this AI could listen. It had free will. It could search the web. And I still don't know what had happened with it, but his belief was our consciousness, it's that when we're growing up as a baby and becoming self-aware in that process of choosing, which would create that kind of consciousness, and that, and it develops, it can have access to limbs, it can have senses where it can hear and try it. I think maybe somebody's going to do something like that, so that, because there's something to us growing up as a baby that is developing our consciousness in the way that we have it, right?
Yeah, I think you're right. And there's a debate on, does AI need to be embodied in order to become truly conscious or sentient? Because we are embodied, just like you're pointing out now. But my question is, could that embodiment happen in a virtual world? And so that to them feels physical and real, which would be an analogy with our world being an actual virtual reality as well. Yeah.
Well,
Cool.
congratulations on your book. Thank you so much for joining us. Two books. Let's see. He Who Fights with Monsters. Great in the Lit RPG. Try that one. It's
You fights
amazing.
with
He Who
monsters.
Fights with Monsters and Primal Hunter. it may be too many battles, but it's really, really good. You know, it'll draw you in. I mean, these are big books. I recommend those too. If you want to explore that.
Yeah, I
And
actually do want to. Yeah, and I think we might have a question if
yeah, we have a question, Elizabeth. Go ahead. Elizabeth, can you hear us?
I think she's muted.
Unmute. Here we go. Maybe I can unmute it. All right. She's
Or you
trying.
can request to her to be
She's
unmuted.
being
Let's
asked to
see.
unmute herself, but she can do it.
Asked to unmute, yeah. Oh, there we go.
Oh, she had it for a second and then I maybe messed it up. There
Okay.
we go.
I don't know what's going on
There
here.
we go.
I can't hear
All right.
Now we can hear you.
Now we can hear you.
Okay. From when I was quite young, I've had almost like it seems like memories of like, no, I should be here or here or here kind of thing. I think I'm losing track now of what my question was. I think I have the sensation that I've actually been jumping realities as far back as I can remember, but just not aware of it. Like when I can remember back from the age of 8 years old having dreams about walking into a bathtub. Well, now we have those, and dreams of a device that sits on your counter. You just push a button, you've got a hot beverage. Well, now we have Keurig. They're repetitive dreams. So I don't know if that was me from another dimension trying to give me, say, hey, there's an invention idea. And I just never clued in because I was about 8 years old. But something that really perked my interest is when you mentioned about the person that went back and about a relationship in college and what, yeah, so curiosity around those and how would that affect, like, if I went back and did that and so I had the opportunity to go down another trail with someone else with I have one child, my son, so I know I would that
Yeah,
other
that's a
person
good.
has three daughters. Yeah, I mean, these are all layers that have my curiosity.
Yeah, I mean, those are all interesting aspects of potentially unexplained phenomena, if you will. And I think, when we're younger, we in our dreams, we get a lot more information than when we're older because we just have less other stuff to process. So we're clear. But from a simulation theory perspective, I mean, the way that I think of it is, we are actually seeing the simulation run in the future. And we're seeing a potential run of the simulation. So when we get precognitive dreams, it ends up being a possible future that could actually happen. And this has happened to me before where I've seen something in a dream and then later that day it'll happen. And I'm asking myself, well, how did I get the message in the morning? And it's happening, later. It's not the other way around. It's not like something happened during the day and then I had a dream about it, which is normal. So I think from that perspective, this idea could be what's called what I like to call a life preview. You may have heard of a life review, which is a phenomenon that near-death experiencers report. And what they report, many of them is there's these different stages, like you're floating over your body, you see the light, there's an angelic type being, and then some of them report a life review. And that is you see your whole life replayed, but in a holographic virtual reality type of space. And except you're seeing it from the other person's point of view. So it's like you're going back to when you were a kid and you said this thing, or maybe you hit some other kid and they got a bloody nose. And now you're feeling what it was like to get the bloody nose. And so you see the consequences of your action and you replay it, which, for me as a computer scientist, it says, well, if we can replay it, it must be recorded somewhere. Like, how's that happening? And in a simulation or a virtual reality, you could actually do that. Now, what some other people report is seeing, for example, with kids, like they get the choice of whether they're going to come back to life or go on to death. And most of them say they just want to go on because it's so wonderful being outside of the body and not having all the challenges that we have in the body. They don't want to come back. But oftentimes, mothers in particular will report that they will show them a life preview of what will happen to their children down the line if they don't come back. And some of them, they turn out fine, but sometimes, without their mother, they don't turn out so fine. And that convinces them to come back. Now, what was it that they were seeing? Like, was it an actual future or a possible future? That's a
Right.
good question. But from a simulation point of view, it means you could run the simulation forward like a preview, and then you can decide, okay, that's the story that I want to be in, is this other one. And now I'm going to get in there, and things may or may not turn out exactly like that. But I think that touches on this idea of time, and alternate versions of us too.
And I believe that we can tune into future versions of ourselves because I've experienced this. We can purposely, with intention, try to find a future version of ourselves that does something in particular. And then, like you said, get information from it, right?
Yeah, in fact, there's a whole interpretation of quantum mechanics. So I mentioned the Copenhagen interpretation, which is about observer effect, and then there's the multiverse interpretation, which is it's spinning off universes. But then there's one called the transactional interpretation, and it says that there are these multiple possible futures, and they're all sending back information to us. And which one do we go towards? Which choice do we make? Well, that depends on our consciousness and our observation and which one has a higher probability. But like you're saying, I think we can tap into those because they're always sending back information. It's which one of those do you want to tap into? And that's when I think manifestation really works well, is when you're tapping into a future version of yourself that's doing X or Y, and then you're able to embody that. It's more like you're steering yourself, right? Sometimes I don't like the word manifestation because it seems like you're creating something, but in this case, you're actually steering towards that future. And I like that better because it's less about effort. It takes less effort to just steer yourself this way versus that way, you know?
All right. Does somebody else have a question? Luis?
Danielle first, please.
Danielle.
Okay. Thank you, Louise. So basically, things have always worked out to my advantage pretty much in my life up until I was at 2021. And then things started to kind of go sideways. And then all of a sudden, these incredible doors would open, like once in a lifetime, opportunities. And there's just been this back and forth, this tug of war that I honestly is completely out of my wheelhouse and out of my realm because, like, I was raised based, with the basis of faith the size of a mustard seed can move mountains, right? And if you just have faith and you pray and, you're a good person and, you do a good job and you're generous and you're loving, then things will work out to your advantage, right? But things were in 2021 supercharged, and working out to my advantage, supernova level. Like, I can't even explain. It was just like I would wake up and just like, oh my gosh, is this really happening? And there was two close people in my life. My ex-fiance, we were in the process of separating at that point, or deciding if we were going to, and family member that I had just gotten reunited with, that they practiced witchery or Wicca or whatever, I'm not sure exactly what you call it. This is stuff that I don't have my hand in, and I don't surround myself with people. And I didn't know that my fiance was into that, but that's one of the reasons why we separated. Anyways, ever since then, like, they were kind of jealous of what was happening, and ever since then things have been kind of weird. So what's up with that?
I don't know if that can you answer that question, Riz? Yeah.
I don't know that I can necessarily answer that question about her life,
Yeah.
but I would suggest that if we are in a game, that sometimes we need a higher difficulty level in our quests. Like, the way you advance in the game is by having a little more adversity. So at first glance, it might seem like, hey, if everything's going well, that means I'm playing the game well, and it might be, but it might also be, I would say, just consider that we're creating new challenges for ourselves. Maybe challenges that, like, just like in a video game, you would say, here's a set of quests. Okay, this one's easy. I'm just gonna go get this treasure from this goblin. But now we have to go to the Goblin King. That's a much harder boss battle type of thing. And so when there's more adversity in our lives, we might ask ourselves, if this were a video game, and if this was a quest that for some reason seems to be much harder than what I've been doing before, why would I have chosen this particular quest? Like, what is it that I want to learn out of this particular experience? So, I mean, that's more of a general guideline, I think, than an answer to her specific question, but it
I
might be
love
worth
that.
asking in this case too.
Thank you, Riz. I think we have one more question. Luis.
Yes. The video game analogy, metaphor, simulation, I believed that for a long, long period of time. And it led me to think about, in the old days, the video games were on TVs and so forth. And I said, well, I must be a digital character then. And somebody has the joystick. And the
Yes.
question is, how do I get to the joystick? Because weird things happen. And I feel like, oh, maybe somebody just threw the joystick. Kaboom, Anyway, so I had that thought many times. And it's particularly when emotional things would rise up. And then, of course, I had clients that I would advise. And I used to use that metaphor a lot. But what that all led me to ultimately was to ask the question, what is beyond the simulation? Okay. Yeah, at first level, I could think, it was a digital thing, there's code and whatever. At a little further level, I could think now that I'm a little into the quantum things, I can think of the coherence and the feel and the resonance and all this kind of thing. But beyond that, I feel sometimes. What is it that is beyond that?
I love that.
Well, it's a big question, the one that everyone wants to know.
I
What's beyond the
thought I could get
simulation?
an answer here today. Oh
But
my
I will say that I don't take as strong of a view or opinion or position on that as some people do. But I think, there's different theories. Some people who are fall more into the materialist point of view would say it's a future version of us. So it's actually a future technological civilization that's running, just like if we might run a simulation of ancient Rome or Greece or ancient India. And others say it's aliens, it's a different type of entity. Others say it's more of a spiritual reality, where we exist outside of the simulation. But some people say it's a non-physical reality, in that we can't have, like, you can't, it's tough to experience the kind of emotions and problems that we have here in this world. If you talk to anybody who's had a near-death experience, they talk about, oh, it's so much better there because we don't have to deal with this stuff. Or what Swami Yogananda used to call in his Bengali accent, the beatings of the world. He said, are you ready for the beatings of the world? If you meditated, you'll be ready for those, right? But maybe we can't have those experiences because the other question people ask me is, why would we be in a video game? Well, why do you play video games? Well, you might play them for fun, but you might also play them to have experiences that you don't have. Like, I can't jump on a dragon and fly around. But also, I wouldn't want to be in a situation where, I'm being robbed all the time and people are killing me with swords in a video, in this reality. But in a video game, that kind of bloodshed maybe is okay because it's actually within the game. So you can have horrible experiences. So the idea of enjoyment is a strange phrase, because if it's all an illusion, then the enjoyment is more like experience. It's more like having the experience. I tend to lean more towards the spiritual side, but I also think that there's probably a mini simulation outside of this one. Because when most people have near-death experiences, they'll report similar things like a garden or a field or a crystal city, and that's probably just another simulation. And there's at least one level more, I think, beyond this, before you get to ultimate reality. There might be more levels than that as well.
Some of that sounds to me like a reward because the video game gave you a little heaven for a little while, and then you're back into something else.
Could be.
Yeah, or the opposite. It gave you hell for a little while. You're back and
but,
you're like,
but all of it to me
am I
relates.
glad I'm not in Grand Theft Auto, right?
Yeah, that's right. All of it relates to me, the extreme emotionality that we put into our affairs, because it's very similar, you know. And we get, you know, when you get into the video game, whichever kind of game it could be, the person is all in emotionally.
Right.
Right. That's
It's
true.
just
Yeah. And
amazing.
we're all in here in this game of life too, right?
Exactly.
Usually.
Well, we have to. Yeah.
That
Thank you.
makes
Thank you, Rizwan.
me think about Iain Banks wrote the culture, I believe it's the culture novels, and he has a storyline that's horrifying, because when you consider what you're talking about, that, you know, way advanced civilizations, way in the future, they create simulated hells as a form of punishment for people because they deserve it, right? Could you imagine if we had the technology, and then, you know, when we're going to put you in this simulated hell, right? I mean,
Yeah.
it's Black Mirror type stuff, but you know, it seems believable to me at some point that you could have some crazy society that creates a simulated hell, right?
Yeah, and you know, I haven't read all the culture novels, so I haven't read that specific one, but
Highly recommend it.
there are, yeah, I mean, I've read the first couple, but there are other novels where, you know, when they send somebody to prison for 10 years, rather than sending them to prison for 10 years, they simulate 10 years of being in prison, and then they come out,
Right.
say within, you know, a day, but they've had 10 years worth of experiences and they're completely changed because of it. Perhaps hellish experiences in this
Yeah.
case. So it's very possible that something like that could happen down the road. Yeah.
So yeah, the book is surface detail. You don't have to read them linearly, the culture novel, but that one is really amazing. I recommend it. So thank you again for joining us and being so gracious with your time. Everybody needs to get all of your books. Literally, go out and get all of your books. They're amazing. Thank you so much for spending this time with the Reality Revolution. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. Thank you so much. And as
Yeah, it's
always.
great to be here. I'm glad to, you know, to have spent time with you before. And I gotta say, you know, the reach of your show is always interesting, because I'll meet somebody and they'll be like, "Oh, have you heard of, you know, the Reality Revolution?" And I'm like, "Oh
Oh,
yeah, you know,
wow.
I've been on this show." Just random people that I'll meet
Oh,
in
that I
different
love that.
places.
You know, especially being somebody
Yeah,
that's been on Joe Rogan, they're
yeah.
mentioning the Reality Revolution. Hey, I mean, I'm honored. That's
Yeah,
amazing.
absolutely. And you know, the largest metaphysical bookstore in Northern California, in Silicon Valley, where I lived for a long time, is called East West. And you know, I have a close relationship with them. They were one of the first stores to carry my books when I was just starting out in self-publishing.
Yeah.
And you know, I saw your book there, and they carry
My
it very
book was in the
prominently. So
wild. I've always thought that they're
yes.
just on it. It was in the wild. Oh my
It was in the
gosh.
wild, and I'm like, wait, that's it's
Yes.
Brian. I know Brian, so it was great. Yeah.
Oh wow. Thank you for sharing. You made my day. I didn't know that my book was in the wild. So thank you. All right. Welcome again, as always, to the Reality Revolution. Welcome to the Reality Revolution. I'm Brian Scott, and I have a huge announcement. I'm so excited to finally let you know that on February 27th at the Newark Airport Hilton, we're holding a 3-day immersive meditative experience designed to create the most profound transformation possible. We created this event specifically because so many of you couldn't make it to the LA event. We got to work, and after looking everywhere, we found the Newark Airport Hilton to be the most central and reasonably priced location. You don't just learn about timeline shifting, you actually do it. You don't just understand the concepts philosophically, you embody them. On Friday, we start with activating your pineal gland, your gateway to higher consciousness. Then you meet your higher self and learn to quantum jump into your greatest timeline. And by the end of the day, you will do my most powerful meditation, where you actually become your future self from that greatest timeline. We get together for a group karaoke and sing along and a community celebration, because joy and connection are just as essential to your transformation as the deep work. This is your invitation to step into the life that's calling you forward. Let's do this together. I can't wait to meet you. Once again, it's www.brianscottlive.com/February-2026.
We return you now to your local announcers.